Today's Teisho will be on case 57 in the Hikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 57 is entitled Joshu's I Alone Am Holy Throughout Heaven and Earth. Engo's introduction: when you have not penetrated it, it is like silver mountains and iron cliffs. When you have penetrated it, you find that you yourself are the silver mountains and iron cliffs. If you ask how to do it, I would just say, if you attain realization in the exercise of ki, you will occupy the pinnacle of attainment and will allow not even the holy ones to spy on you. If you cannot do this, see and study the ancients' doings as follows. Main subject: a monk said to Joshu, "It is said the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." Now, what are preferences? Joshu said, I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. The monk said, there are still preferences. Joshu said, "You country bumpkin, where are the preferences?" The monk was speechless. Secho's verse: deep is the sea, high as the mountains, the flies attempt to face the gale, the ant trying to attack the pillar, choice and attachment, no choice and no attachment, a cloth-covered drum that reaches the eaves. So, the main figure in this Teisho is one of the great heroes of Zen, one of the great figures of Zen, which is Master Joshu. Joshu and Rinzai lived in the same period, and of course our tradition is called Rinzai Zen. But actually, Joshu influenced all the different schools of Zen enormously, and as you know, we are in his debt, because when we start our training after working with the breath perception koan, we begin to work with the mu koan, which was Joshu's invention. I've mentioned before that Joshu was quite a remarkable person. Before he was even 20 years old, he had an awakening experience, and he set off looking for a teacher who can help him, who could help him to deepen his insight after that initial quite amazing experience. And he ran into Master Nansen, Master Nansen, and a number of koans deal with Nansen and Joshu together, and their life together, and then Nansen basically died. He lived to be quite old, and he died when Joshu was already becoming rather old. I believe that Joshu was in his 60s, but people expected Joshu to take over Nansen's temple, but he didn't do it. He decided that he would travel around China and try to learn even more about enlightened mind than he already had from his own experience and from his study with Nansen. So during a long period, Joshu was just living on the road, going from monastery to monastery and meeting great teachers, including Hyakucho. So He would go to monasteries and stay as a guest in the guest quarters, and participate in sesshin and so on. And sometimes he would meet people who had experienced awakened mind in ways that he had not yet experienced. And from those people, he would learn a great deal. And sometimes he would encounter people who were really not as far along in their training. And sometimes people would challenge him to see if he was really deeply enlightened or not. Sometimes these challenges were from people who weren't at all awake. They just resented Joshu's fame and his freedom. He seemed to be so unconcerned about things like his reputation or any other matter of that kind. So in this case, this is a koan from that period in Joshu's life. And by the way, after this period, he invented the Mu koan when he was quite old, more than 100 years old. And it became the foundation for practice in Zen. And even though Joshu had no, his lineage died out very quickly, his influence has been quite significant. So, a monk said to Joshu, "It is said in the Shinshin Ming, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." Now, what does it mean basically to have no preferences? See, the monk is basically quizzing Joshu because Joshu liked to go around and quote the Shinshin Ming. It was one of Joshu's favorite scriptures. So when somebody would ask Joshu a question, sometimes Joshu would just quote the Shinshin Ming, the verses we recited this morning. Sometimes people would ask Joshu, "What is Buddha?" And he'd say, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." Somebody would ask him, "What is enlightenment?" And he would say, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." And, "What do you want for dinner?" "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." See? So, you know, you could understand if you didn't have an awakened mind, you might think, who is this phony baloney, you know, who goes around just quoting these verses and seems so pleased with himself? Yeah. And so a monk came up to Joshu and he said, "You know, you go around quoting the Shinshin Ming, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. What does it mean, anyway, to have no preferences?" And Joshu quotes another line. He quotes the line from the Buddha, which the Buddha is supposed to have recited. "I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth." And the monk said, "Well, that's a preference." And Joshu said, "You bumpkin, you idiot. Show me where there are preferences." And the monk was speechless. Probably he just didn't understand and he gave up and he went away. When you get up in the morning, if you get up in the morning, when you get up in the morning, you might notice something, you know. The first moments when you wake up, if you pay attention, you might notice that you, unless you've had a very powerful dream, when you first wake up, when you first become conscious, you might notice that your mind is actually very clear, very clear, very calm. Especially if you've done zazen the night before, this might be true. Just as you wake up, you know, if you pay attention, you'll notice that your mind might be, it's quite likely that your mind is going to be quite calm and quite clear. And you're lying in bed and you might notice that you're calm, you know, that there's a kind of simplicity about your consciousness at that moment. And then maybe you feel the sheets, or you feel the warmth of your bed, or you think about breakfast. Something like that, you know. That clarity, that simplicity is quite important, really very important. And it's sad to say that we don't spend ordinarily, we aren't able to remain in that simplicity very long. You know, one of the reasons we do meditation early in the morning is precisely because the mind is in that condition when we wake up. So those of you who have gone to Sesshin, to the wonderful institution of Sesshin, know that when we get up, we get up pretty early, 4:30, you get to the cushion, and we generally recite sutras, or we always recite sutras, but in that interval while we're waiting for everybody to come into the Zendo, if you look at your mind again, you'll notice it's very clear and unobstructed. It's very simple, really simple. Then we recite sutras, and we have tea, and then we have a bathroom break, and then we come back to the cushion. And it's still very early. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning, and the mind is very clear in that state. And I myself almost always have the best sits the best sits in the morning. About 2 weeks ago, I was up in Blairstown, and I was sitting. And I'm not boasting, but I had a sit that was so great. It's been a long time since I had such a great sit. It was just, there was nothing made it special, nothing. My mind was really blank. I was really in that simplicity. And I just felt, all of a sudden I realized, I feel fantastic, you know. I just feel like I'm in heaven. And after the sitting was over, I drove home. And all day long I was so happy, you know, I was like singing to myself, and really. The next day I got up and I sat, same thing, you know. Sometimes you just, I think practice comes in waves. You know, sometimes you're in a slump, you know. You're sitting on the cushion, not much is going on. Not much, you know, is happening. But sometimes you're on the crest of a wave, you know. It's a bit mysterious, but I just had this great sit. And if you ask me why, there was no reason, you know, except that I was just fully present in the moment in this very simple way, you know, very simple. And there were no objectives, you know, no goals, no assessment of performance, and no expectations, really, you know. It was just sitting. I went up there, I sat, and I went into like heaven. It was like heaven. And this has happened to me a lot in my 35 years of sitting, but this was really a surprise because it's been a little while since I had this sit of this intensity and purity. And I was just singing all day for a couple days. So if you observe your mind, when you get up in the morning, just as you're waking up, just as you come to consciousness, there's a moment there, if you look at your mind, where you're just very simple and present, and there isn't a lot of mental activity, and it's too soon for you to begin to form goals, you know, or objectives, or start really thinking. Please conduct this experiment. Now, sometimes it's not possible to do this because you might have had some difficult dreams, and when you wake up, you're in sort of an anxious state. But generally speaking, when you first wake up, your mind is very clear. And then, you know, you might notice something that's very curious. When you wake up and your mind is clear and calm like this, you might notice that after a while, you begin to become anxious. You might suddenly notice that there's like it's like to the right of your mind, on the right-hand side of your mind, so to speak, you notice that there's anxiety somewhere over there, yeah? And it's like a thread in a cloth. It's like a red thread in a white cloth. Or it's like you're going from a room that's quiet and you're going into another room where there's a kind of like a phone is ringing or something, you know. It's, you suddenly realize that there's this this band of anxiety over on the right hand side, or, you know, so to speak. Then, you know, if you you might find that that anxiety can become very consuming. Now, I don't know. I'm asking you to conduct an experiment. You know, because I don't know if everybody's mind works the same way. But you know, you may not have a band of anxiety running through your consciousness. You know, and your mind may just be placid and calm. But some people, when they get up, you know, they're calm, and then they notice there's this, like, this band of anxiety, you know. And just explore, see if that's the case, you know. People can get stuck in that current, that, like, that they get caught in that band of anxiety, you know. That it's like there's a little river flowing by, and it's and when you stand in it, you feel anxious, you know, and it's hard to get out of it again once you're in that anxiety. And you can spend your whole day sort of in that current of anxiety. It's like an electric current flowing through your body. But we do have these intervals where we're not in that electric current, where we're just calm and quiet, especially when we get up. But people spend a lot of time in that anxious consciousness, and sometimes they can't get out of it. And all day long, you know, there's like this undercurrent of anxiety. You know, I sometimes think that our anxieties are not produced by our circumstances, you know? I have known people who are incredibly incredibly calm in the middle of, like, a lot of chaos, you know? I work with people who are pretty good at handling stress. And sometimes our office gets very crazy, and I notice that that a couple of my colleagues, especially Michael, he just seems to be able to keep going calmly even when things are very stressful. On the other hand, I have another person who works in my office who's always very stressed, even when not much is going on. So I think that sometimes if you feel like you're in the flow, in this current of stress, this current of nervousness, it's really not necessarily caused by what's happening. It's like a deep mental habit. It's like a deep mental habit. And it comes from, I think, you know, really like events in our lives that are very deep-rooted, you know, very deep-rooted. It has to do with maybe things we've experienced long ago that become habitual, you know. When we're in that mind, we always feel impoverished, or we might feel threatened, right? Threatened or endangered. Or we might feel impoverished, you know, like we're looking through a window at a group of people who are having a lovely meal and we're hungry, right? There's a kind of, when we're in that mindset, there's a kind of desperation, you know? And you can see yourself acting from this desperate place sometime, especially if you meditate and you look at your mind, you'll notice, you know, I'm acting from a very desperate place. You know, I'm acting from this place where I'm feeling very hungry and unnourished, untaken care of, right? This has its roots in very old karma, you know. Who knows why? Why we are like this? But it probably has to do with early childhood experiences that become, you know, created a mindset that has become habitual, you know. And so we're always going around in this state of like hunger, you know, where we feel deprived. And we're always in our relationships with people, we're asking them to feed us, you know, and they might not get the message that you want to be fed, and then you might get mad, or you might feel hopeless, or you might feel anger at yourself, right? These are all emotions that are quite common in this part of ourselves, right? You know, basically there's a kind of consciousness which is as I'm describing it, right? It feels like a pulse of anxiety, and it's usually accompanied by feelings of like anger or deprivation, insecurity, right? And it's like insatiable. Mind, you know, this mind is like insatiable. When you're in this mind, you feel, often you feel like hot, right? Like it's a hot, it's like a burning red thread running through this white cloth, you know, or it's like a laser beam, you know, it's hot. And when you're in this mind, you feel, you know, you feel hot, you know, you feel you're burning, you know, and often when we're in this mind, we just keep repeating the same behaviors over and over again, you know. So a lot of people grow up feeling uncared for or unloved, and they go around in their interactions all day in a certain way asking for love or not asking for love, but wishing they had the courage to ask for love, right? Or attention or respect. And so, you know, when they're not given what they need, they can become angry or depressed or self-loathing, right? And we tend to repeat these cycles over and over again. You know, I just didn't know, I never knew this, but the word samsara in Sanskrit is related to going around and around in a circle. So when the Buddha was talking about human suffering, he was talking about going around and around in a circle, right? It's like samsara is the mind that keeps repeating and repeating the same dramas over and over and over again, and it can't get out. It can't get out of these cycles, right? These loops. A good friend of mine told me the other day that she was having had many, many years of very difficult relationship with her mother. She was telling me the other day that she's finally, her mother is now deceased, and she's sort of living her own life. And she said, you know, I realize now for so many years of my life, I was going around all day playing these loops in my head, like tape loops. And they were playing and playing and playing. And she said, sometimes now, there's moments I realize when those loops, those tapes are not playing in my head anymore. And I'm just sort of in the moment. This person doesn't meditate, by the way, but I thought that was such a revealing statement, you know. Because her face seemed very peaceful when she said this. And I think that when the Buddha was talking about samsara, he was really talking about this undercurrent of anxiety, or where we're repeating these elemental behaviors that we learned long ago, right? And we keep not solving the problem we're trying to solve, you know. So maybe we feel neglected and we're going up to people and saying, feed me, and they don't feed us, and then we get mad, or et cetera, et cetera. And this is like the basic human experience, I think. Very, very important element of human nature is this burning red thread, you know, that runs through the white cloth of our minds. And it's tied in with all kinds of things that have happened to us. But there's another mind, right, that we all experience if we've done zazen. You know, if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, sooner or later you find yourself in the moment in a way that's different from the mind I just discussed. You know, it's actually really wonderful. And it's characterized by the absence of that kind of desperation, which in the Buddhist literature is called craving. So you know, normally we're craving. We're like hungry beings who can't be fed. And we're looking for food, you know. We're looking for various kinds of food. It could be a raise. It could be worldly fame. It could be romance, you know. There's lots of ways in which we want to be fed. Some of them are healthier than others. You know? And sometimes we find bad food, right? It makes us feel fed, but it's not good for us, like alcohol. So the mood of this undercurrent of anxiety that you might notice after a while when you wake up is craving and burning, right? It's a, you know, really like that. It's desperate, and it's looking everywhere for its food, but it can't find what will put it at ease. Put it, you know, can't find what it's looking for. Every once in a while, if we do zazen, though, we fall into a different mind, which is this mind that is absolutely like when you first wake up. You know, it's absolutely, it's sort of empty, right? And it's simple, right? It's just quite amazing to be fully present in the moment without any agenda, and with the absence of craving, right? So sometimes when we're sitting, we're just here, and we're not expecting anything, right? And we're not really looking desperately for something. We're just coming back. Maybe it's boring even. But if you do this repetitively, your mind begins to enter this state. You begin to enter this condition in which all craving disappears, and you feel you feel open, and it's as though the walls are gone and the world has gotten a little bigger. Yeah, there's no obstructions. And it's like you can finally breathe. You know, there's no pressure, right? No pressure. You know, basically, often this is characterized also by like a lack of thinking. Some of the thinking we do is like practical and reasonable. But if you watch your mind going through a day, I think you will notice that sometimes your thinking is quite neurotic, and it's closely associated with your craving, you know, and these anxieties and unmet hunger, this unmet hunger, unsatisfied hunger. And it's accompanied by a certain degree of anxiety. So as I say, some thinking is okay. It's like, I've got to call so-and-so about this, you know. But if you look at your mind, a lot of the mental activity during the day, at least some of the mental activity during the day, is tied in with these loops, right? And sometimes we can become so caught in the loops, in the samsaric loops, that it's hard to be present in the moment at all. I'm sure you've had that experience where maybe something has happened to you, maybe you had an argument with somebody, and the next day all you can think about is the argument. And it's so hard to be present, right? So hard to be present. And there's this urgency or desperation to your reflections, and you feel it's like burning. So you know, the Buddha's position is that we need to understand the sources of our burning, but we need to also understand that there's no solution when you're in that state, right? That the solution is to get out of that state. So, you know, meditation is a way of getting out of that state. It takes a lot of discipline to not stay in the red thread, in the red current, right? But to step over into that calm place again. You know, that's when we watch our breath, it takes us from that anxiety, that pulsing anxiety, over into the moment, just as it is, in its pure presence. Being fully present in the moment is liberation, according to the Buddha. Being fully present in the moment without the undercurrent of anxiety is liberation. That's it. Now you might think, how disappointing. You know, where is the ecstasy? But just stay there for a while and see. It's really quite wonderful. So if you enter this state of pure presence, being just with the moment without any agendas and without any craving, it's really quite amazing. The Buddhist word for this state is tat-atta, pure presence. Thus, it's called thusness, thusness, here-ness. Here and now-ness, right? Or this-ness. You know. Just this. In Zen we say just this. This-ness. Here it is. The sound of the fan. Here it is. The pain in my legs. Here it is. You know, the sound of rain on the windowsill. You know. And even though those might seem trivial, when you're in that state, and the red current, you're not immersed in that red current of craving, it feels cool and open. It's liberating. You know, so basically, samsara is the loops, right? The loops of the repetitive mental behaviors, you know, where you're going back again and again to your fear, your hunger, your anger, right? Over and over again. And we all do this sometime, you know, especially if something has been very painful or difficult. You know, we fall back into sometimes these loops, right? You know, when we practice meditation, we learn how to step out of that and be present in the moment. And in the absence of craving and the desperation, let's say the burning desperation of craving, right? We sit quietly in the present moment, and eventually that's very, very liberating. You know, it's very healing. And all kinds of wonderful things are possible if we can learn to be in that state. And so a lot of Zen practice is the struggle between falling back into these mental habits, which are associated with burning and craving and the loops, and being in this state, which is like paradise, which is the pure presence of the moment. Now, you know, usually it's not quite this dramatic, right? you know, we're not usually in like acute distress all the time, although some people are, and then they become depressed. But we're usually not in acute distress, right? We sort of have like an undercurrent of distress, and you know, it's a little hard sometimes to just be in the moment. But if you practice Zen long enough, you begin to slip into these wonderful moments where there's just nothing going on. It's just the pure presence of thisness. And I can't tell you how liberating this is, how wonderfully liberating it is to be in this state. I'm sure you've experienced it, but if you keep practicing, if you keep going back there, you know, it gets deeper and deeper. You know, it really becomes quite astonishingly wonderful. If you haven't discovered that already, please keep practicing. So it's really challenging to let go of our fears and our attachments. It's very difficult. Because, you know, we're still hungry. It's like we're still hungry. So one of the reasons we just don't give up on the things that cause us so much anxiety and fear is that we're still unfed, you know. So we're looking for that thing that's going to feed us. And, you know, it might be impossible to find in a certain way, you know. My brother always wanted to be loved by my father. You know, he wanted, my father and my brother never got along very well. And my brother did so many things to try to get my father's attention and get his approval. And my brother just couldn't do it. My father wouldn't see my brother. He never turned to my brother and said, "You are a good boy. I really love you." You know, he just didn't do it. But the things my brother did do, my father didn't approve of, you know. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, what was it called? Oh, it's a beautiful movie. It's called, oh, it escapes me right now, I'm so sorry. It's a wonderful movie based on a John Steinbeck book. And it's starring an actor who's totally forgotten now named Ralph Bellamy. Ralph Bellamy plays the father. And James Dean is the son. So if you Google Ralph Bellamy and James Dean, you can get the title. But it's absolutely East of Eden. Okay, it's a wonderful movie because basically the James Dean character is the younger brother, and he can't get his father's approval, and he does so much to get his, just like with my brother and my father, and everything he does his father dismisses, and his father's a very good man, so his son borrows some money and gets involved in buying stocks in companies that provide clothing for soldiers going to war. So the boy James Dean basically tries to make some money for his dad, who's having some financial problems. So he borrows some money. And he invests in these companies that make clothing for soldiers. And of course, the war breaks out, and the stocks go through the ceiling. So James Dean comes back to his dad with a big, you know, box full of money and says, "Look what I've done. I've made all this money in the market for you." And the father said, "Well, son, that's wonderful, but how did you do it?" And the son says, I invested in companies that make uniforms for soldiers." And the father said, "You mean you made money off of war?" Right? And you can see the son's face. He's it's like, oh no. You know, and the father said, I can't accept that money. It's covered with blood. It's like, oh no. This is so sad, right? Because the son wants to be loved by the father, and the father is rejecting his gift, right? Is rejecting his gift. This is like elemental. This is like human life 101. And so the son just is in complete despondence, right? You know, so this is so human, right? This is so human. I mean, maybe you had a happier childhood, but maybe there's something like this in your past, right? And this is, you know, and so we go through life, even maybe after our parents are dead, we're looking for that approval. You know, we're looking for somebody to go, I see you, and I love you, and you're such a good boy or such a good girl. And, you know, then we go to work and the boss says, your report was okay, you know, it was okay. It could be improved in these ways. And, you know, instead of just going, okay, I'll improve my report, one might go home and say, oh my God, here it's happening again, you know, Dad, he never approved, you know. And even though we can know intellectually that this is how we're behaving, doesn't necessarily liberate us. You know, knowing doesn't always solve the problem. So we all have like this. The Buddha talked about craving, yeah, craving, tanha. There's like this undercurrent of craving that we all carry. It's something we didn't get. You know, something we didn't get, and we're looking for it all the time. You know, and this consciousness is anxious, you know, and fearful, and burning, you know. But sometimes when we learn how to just be in the moment, all of a sudden there's this tremendous sense of fullness. It's like out of emptiness comes this fullness. It's very curious, you know. You know, you're in the moment, and you're just in the moment, and you're watching your breath, and you hear the fan, and there's no hope of sort of satisfying this hunger you have, you know. And you're just in the moment, and you're watching your breath, and you're watching your breath, and all of a sudden, you know, you can get this wonderful feeling of fullness. And it's like your heart suddenly leaps up, and you feel, you have this feeling of spaciousness and calmness and coolness, but also like vibrant liveliness. It's like liveliness. And you feel connected to things, right? And so suddenly it's like the craving goes away and there's this sense of satisfaction or connected. It's like having had a good meal, you know? This happens to me quite often on the cushion, you know, where I'll feel very connected, very full. It's like my hunger has been taken care of, you know, in the moment. So this is kind of what's going on in this koan. You know, Joshu spends a lot of time in that state of mind where he's just present in the moment, and he's been filled up with the moment. And the craving, he doesn't live that life of desperate craving. He's in this other state, which is the pure presence of the moment, you know. And he acts from that place. So, you know, he's always impressive to people because he isn't, you know, some people are shaky. You know, you meet them and underneath the surface there's anxiety, fear or anger or a hunger, right? And you know, you might not know why, but there's a kind of hunger there, or deficiency. You know, it's like there's something missing. The person can't be fully present because the person's still looking for something, you know. And you know, we might not consciously register this, but it's like there's a kind of uneasiness in the person we're talking to, you know. But sometimes you meet people who have a kind of confidence or fullness. You know, they have a kind of fullness. And it's because they're not needy. They're not asking you for something. They're not disappointed if you're not a certain way. They're just present with you, you know, in a very pleasing way. And it's quite unusual, right? Because most people are looking for something from us, or they're angry at us, or they're trying to get us to buy something or something, you know. But sometimes you're with people who just are present with you. And they don't even necessarily want to be your friend. They don't want to be your enemy. They're just happy to be there with you in the moment. And I think such people are quite liberating, you know. So I think Joshu was one of these people who, you know, when you were around him, you generally people felt good, you know. They generally felt good because he wasn't craving all the time, you know. He was just happy. It's like the other day I was with a friend of mine who has a little baby. And the baby was so happy. You know, the baby was just like really totally happy. It was just really having a good time. Now, I'm sure that baby has some moments where it's really miserable, you know, but I was seeing a baby at the best. And the baby was so happy. You know, there was, and, you know, that's possible to be like that sometime, you know. The baby is just present in the moment, happy to be there, because it doesn't yet know it should be unhappy because it doesn't have something, right? So, you know, probably this mother is a really good mother, and the baby feels a sense of well-being and is present, fully present, you know, and it was just delighted to be there. And I think Joshu was like a big baby. You know, he was just really happy to be there. Have you noticed the Dalai Lama has this quality of being like a big baby? Have you noticed that? It's not just that he doesn't have any hair like a baby. It's that he's not trying, you know. He's just happy to be there, you know. And there's a kind of quality to the Dalai Lama which is slightly like a baby, you know. And it's actually very pleasing. Lao Tzu was like that too, you know. Lao Tzu was like a big baby, you know. He was just happy to be there, very liberating. So you know, Joshu was like that. You know, some people would be impressed by this guy who was this. Apparently, Joshu was quite big. He was quite tall, and he did have a shaved head. He was a monk. And he seemed very happy all the time because he wasn't craving. There wasn't this undercurrent, just present in the moment. And it was very liberating. People found that very exciting, you know, sometimes to be around. So in this encounter, you know, a monk says to Joshu, basically, you could read the koan this way. The monk is really speaking from this hungry mind, this mind of craving. And he wants to get free from this relentless craving mind, you know, this mind of from that red thread, that red current. And he's in there and he can't get out. And he's just repeating and repeating and repeating. And he's burning, right? He's burning up. And he says to Joshu, you know, it's said the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Now, what does it mean to have no preferences? And Joshu basically tries to show him the mind that has no preferences. You know, no matter what happens, it's okay, right? It's okay. And the monk doesn't get it, right? Joshu says, when I'm in the state of enlightened mind, everything is just present here. That's what he says. He says, I alone, how does he put it? This is what the Buddha said upon awakening. I alone am holy throughout heaven and earth. Well, the Buddha wasn't saying, I'm a special guy, I alone have had enlightenment. What the Buddha was saying is, I feel connected to everything around me in the present moment, 100%. See, there's no boundary between myself and the world. And therefore, craving has disappeared. Right? So the Buddha, when he achieved his enlightenment, said, there's no longer any separation between me and the world. I alone am holy. Meaning, everything is my true nature. Everything is my true self. See? And in that state, there's no longer craving. It's just freedom. It's just freedom. And the monk doesn't get it. He says, "Well, aren't you still trapped in craving?" And Joshu says, "You bumpkin, you're just not in the right mindset yet. You know, you're not in the moment." He said, "Where are choice and attachment? In this moment, find it. Basically, find what you're looking for in this moment." You know, we look everywhere but here. From Joshu's standpoint, your liberation is always possible in every moment if you stop looking, you step out of that mind that is craving and you be just here without judgment. Right? We don't know if that monk ever woke up or not. And Joshu went on to develop the Mu Koan, which is maybe even a better koan than this one. But it's certainly the case that, you know, it's important to do zazen every day. And it's important to be in mu, or be in the breath, 100%. And you can tell when you're likely to be, when you feel desperate, when you feel a sense of urgency or pressure, you know you're in your samsaric mind. When you feel that heat, that pressure, that sense of desperation, you know you're in your samsaric mind. And you shouldn't trust that mind. You need to get into the calm mind that's fully present. Don't trust your samsaric mind. You know, many years ago, in our Zen center, we were involved in some activity. I can't remember what it was, or we were planning some activity, and it became very stress creating for all of us. And we were running around like crazy in the Zendo, and Genki Roshi came in and he said, "What are you doing?" And we said, "We're getting ready for this. We have to do all this stuff, and you know we." And Genki Roshi said, "Look." He said, "Nothing can be accomplished that's any good when you're in this state." He said, "It's either going to happen or it's not going to happen." You know, he said, "But if you're in this sort of tense, frenzied state, this anxious, worried state, you know, it's not going to have good results. You need to act from this place that's calm and that isn't worried about success or failure and so on and so on. It's not coming from that place of craving, that burning craving place." And that really stuck with me, you know. Sometimes I wish Genki Roshi had tried a little harder. You know, sometimes he seemed a little too laid back to me, you know. But I understand, I learned a lot from that moment, because he was saying, "Look at your mind. What you're doing now, is it producing anxiety, stress, and desperation, or is it producing a sense of openness and fullness?" See, fullness. And probably a lot of us, if we looked at our minds at that moment, would say we're in a very hungry, desperate mind right now. So if we were honest, we would have said, "Yes, this is coming. We're coming from a place of desperation." But sometimes you're not. Sometimes you're coming from a place that's really—it's just calm. There's nothing to be gained. You're not trying to save yourself or anything. You're just acting spontaneously from the moment, and that's the goal, right? That's the kind of joyous action that somebody like Joshu was capable of. And so, you know, you have to watch your own mind and see when you're hot and burning with craving, and see when your mind is calm and at rest. And any time you're acting from that craving place, that burning craving place, that's not right action. That's only going to make things worse. So there's no goal that justifies that. The thing is to act from a calm place where there's no preferences. There's not any winning and losing. There's no success and failure. This is a very deep teaching. This is what Genki Roshi was trying to show us. You know, he said, "You guys are, you know, you're running around like your hair's on fire." You know, he said, "You know, not much good can come out of this if your mind is in this anxious, craving place. Try to act from this place. You sit down on the cushion. The best days for me are the day, you know, every once in a while I don't sit. But mostly every day I sit. And I get up and I sit down on the cushion and I get up and I go off to my job, and it's much easier to work through the day if I've started in this calm place. You know, I'm not in that craving mind so often. And I can make better decisions, be a little friendlier, etc., etc." So please, you know, watch your mind. See those moments when you're acting from a craving place, and those moments when you're acting from your big mind, from the mind that has no gain and no loss, right? It's hard to be there sometimes, but it's a much better place to be. And when we're on the cushion especially, we can get in touch with that pure presence. Secho's verse: "Deep is the sea, high is the mountain. The flies attempt to face the gale." See, sometimes we're like a little fly trying to swim, trying to flap our wings, and the gale is pushing us. See, that feeling is unhealthy. That's an unhealthy mental state. Where, oh my God, I'm like a little fly and the gale is pushing me. See, that's a divided mind. That's divided mind. You know, that's a desperate mind. That's a craving mind. The ant trying to attack the pillar. Right? You have to become the gale. You have to become the pillar. See? You become one with your circumstances. And they may not be the ones we want, but when we become one, when we're in the mind that's the world-embracing mind, you know, all of our problems go away, and there's this great sense of liberation, calm, and trust.